Hi everyone, I'm Gary Knoll, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Our theme today deals with Anthony Fauci, arguably the most powerful and considered expert on this pandemic in the world. But what if he is not an expert? What if all that we've learned about him is propaganda, self-serving interest? How would you know? The mainstream media has refused to divulge anything about his discrepancies, contradictions, and out-and-out falsehoods. We've been led to believe that he's almost as important as religion, if not religion, certainly the cult of Fauci.
We're going to deconstruct the myths of Fauci today in the case against Fauci and the larger agenda behind the COVID-19 pandemic. My guest today, Robert Kennedy Jr., who's an ardent defender of the environment and the health of children, now is a leading
international protector
of the environment. Robert Kennedy is the founder and president of the Waterkeeper Alliance and the Children's Health Defense, an advocacy organization dedicating itself to enlightening the public about toxic risks to children, including vaccines and autism, looking at aluminum and fluoride and pesticides and food additives and genetically modified foods and electromagnetic technology like G5s, none of which have been challenged by the mainstream media. In fact, promoted by the New York Times, where they're one of the leading sponsors of information on 5G technology. And yet, Robert Kennedy has shown the other side of that supposed utopian way of bringing us all together, the Internet of all things. The organization is also a watchdog on federal and state vaccine policies. Yet he is very much pro-vaccine, but he is pro-safe and effective vaccines. Did you ever ask yourself, how is it that so many people, as many as 30% of all people working in medicine and healthcare, nurses and board certified physicians, are refusing this vaccine is because they're anti-vax? To the contrary, everyone that I know is pro-vax, myself included. But we're pro-proof that they are safe. And that's what Robert's interested in. So what we're going to do today is we're going to take you through an extensive area that is not ever exposed by the light of true journalism, objective journalism. So that's what we're going to do. And Robert Kennedy has a new book out on this very topic. I believe it's number one on Amazon, and which in and of itself is something because the mainstream media refuses to debate Robert Kennedy or any of the hundreds of locally and nationally known physicians and scientists who are all pro-orthodox. They've had no controversy in their background whatsoever. They're pro-vaccine, and yet they all have something to say about Fauci and what we're being told is the right and wrong way. Robert holds a degree from Harvard University and law degrees from the University of Virginia and Pace University School of Law. Earlier, Robert served as the Assistant District Attorney for New York City. His websites are childrenshealthdefense.org and robertfkennedyjr.com. Nice to have you with us today, Robert.
Good to be with you, Gary.
After reviewing your book, I think it is brilliant, and every person listening and watching this needs a copy, even given it as a Christmas gift to a cranky family member or friend or relative who has swallowed the media's propaganda touting Anthony Fauci and Bill Gates' narrative. However, the larger take-home message for me and many others is that all of humanity is now being challenged by misinformation. And your work goes well beyond the pandemic as simply a serious health issue, which it is, but one that is not going to be fatal to the whole world, which we've been told. This is an event that has gradually been percolating for several decades behind the closed doors of government agencies, private corporations like Big Pharma, the military-industrial complex, and shadow intelligence elites, in order to bring a full fruition of other agendas and other goals. And today's program, you'll have a chance to explore those uninterrupted. Also, the severity of SARS-2 virus and all the other various measures being taken, such as lockdowns, masks, quarantines, isolation, the vaccines, and then the booster vaccines, all with the promise that we're going to return to normal. I believe that these are just shells, veneers, covering the much more deeply structured pursuits that the pandemic has simply enabled to be implemented. Your last chapter really dives into this. One place we might start is to point out that you have observed that the national response to the pandemic has not been one based upon medical and public health principles. Rather, it has been a militarized response. Please take your time. We're commercial free, and address this in greater depth, because I really believe that we need to understand the crucial boundary between public health policy to protect the citizenry and policies for the other political, economic, and non-health related goals. The forum is yours.
Well, the thank you, Gary. The response, if you look at the response to COVID, you know, Tony Fauci is called America's doctor, but he never did for us what you would want a doctor to do, which is to stand before the American people the way that FDR did and say the only thing that we have to fear is fear itself. Instead, he became a promoter of fear. And what you would want from a person who is properly managing the pandemic is very, very clear, not only directives, but also very clear data, so that the public could understand and could critique the rationales. We should have known from the beginning what the infection fatality rate was, what the case fatality rate was, how those fatality rates compared to the seasonal flus, how they were stratified among all the different age groups. So what is the risk for higher age groups, and is that different than lower age groups? And many, many, many other questions, and all of it, you know, all of the data seemed deliberately obscure, obfuscated, confused, and manipulated. And then the response, you know, clearly from the beginning, countries like China immediately posted early treatment protocols. And for every disease, infectious disease, when you go to a doctor and say, I have an infectious disease, he treats you. This was the first time we ever had a disease in which Tony Fauci and every doctor in America under his direction said, there is no treatment, there's nothing we can do, go home and lock yourself up. And which is the opposite of what the Chinese did. The Chinese ended their pandemic in April. The rate of death in China was, on a national basis, was about 3 per million, according to the Chinese. And that's consistent with other countries that did early treatment. In our country, which didn't do early treatment, the death rate was 2,200 per million. So with close to 800 times what the countries that were doing early treatment. Tony Fauci's strategy was, he never got on TV and said everybody should be taking vitamin D. As it turns out, vitamin D, 78% of the people who died from COVID were vitamin D deficient. There was a study that there are many, many studies that show that vitamin D really obliterates COVID. And that was known, you know, we've known the effectiveness of vitamin D against coronavirus for decades. If you go to any pharmacy, you will see shelves groaning under zinc products and vitamin D products as remedies for the common cold. Well, you know, why weren't we promoting those things? Why weren't we promoting zinc uptake and quercetin, which is an ionosphere, which facilitates zinc? That's what the Chinese were doing, the entrance of zinc into the cells. Why weren't we doing things like telling people, why didn't Tony Fauci get up on TV and say, you know, we need to get exercise, we need to be out in the sunshine, we need to lose weight, because obesity is clearly going to be a very, very strong comorbidity. We should stop drinking sugar drinks because that causes inflammation. We should stop eating chemical residues. Be careful what you eat, and telling us how to bolster our immune system. How do you do basic things like isolate the sick? And then, you know, which is what China did. If you got sick and you had a positive PCR test, you were immediately isolated and treated with a, and the Chinese published a protocol for treatment by April of 29, 2020. Today in our country, and by the way, the top thing on it was chloroquine, which is their version of hydroxychloroquine. They had antibiotics, anti-inflammatories, anticoagulants, all the things we know today are very, very effective against COVID. They had dozens and dozens of Chinese herbs that contain quercetin, that contain a variety of vitamins, particularly vitamin C, which is very, very important. Why weren't we told to do this? Why is it today, 2 years later, there still is not an early treatment protocol for COVID? And what we did in this country was exactly the opposite of what you would want to do if you wanted to stop a pandemic. If somebody comes into the hospital and they're sick, you don't send them home where they're going to infect their family. And this is what Tony Fauci's policy was. We send you home. And by the way, my mother, when I talked to my mom's doctor, who was a straight Fauci acolyte, and I said, my mother is 93 years old. I said, what if she gets sick? What are we going to do for early treatment? He said, there is no early treatment. She goes home. When she can't breathe, we'll send her up to Mass General Hospital and get her intubated and give her remdesivir. And that was, which both things, which will kill you. So, and that was, that is the protocol today. And that was the protocol from the beginning. Why weren't we told, you know, take anti-inflammatories, take, you know, get us on the steroids, even monoclonal steroid antibodies, which were available very, very early, and sat in storage houses. What Tony Fauci did is he took all the sick people, and instead of isolating them, he sent them home. Till they got so sick, they had to come back to the hospital, and every one of those hospitalizations was a super spreader event. Because now the person who is so sick they can't breathe, they're putting off these enormous viral loads, and they're infecting the Uber driver, members of their family, the people from DoorDash who come to visit them, the people in the ambulance, the people in the hospitals. And there was a million of those hospitalizations, and every one of them infected other people. It's a, you know, this is actually the direct inverse of what you would want to do if you wanted to stop a pandemic. And the results speak for themselves. The, you know, there are many countries, China, the countries that use hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin in South Asia and Africa, that have deaths per million of, you know, of 2, 3, 4, 5, 10, 20, 50, 200. We had in our country 2,200 deaths per million population. One of the highest ratios in the world. We had by far the highest COVID body count on Earth. America has 4.2% of the population, and we had about 20% of the COVID deaths. How is Tony Fauci still in office with that track record? He literally had one of the worst track records of any health minister in the world. And, you know, it was because they were not practicing medicine. They were using this militarized response to lock us down, to impose all of these mandates that have no, you know, he says, well, we couldn't do hydroxychloroquine because there's no placebo-controlled studies. Well, there's no placebo-controlled studies for masks or for lockdowns or for social distancing. And yet he imposed those. And the cost of those on the American people on our culture, on our values was catastrophic, and particularly on our children and our economy. And there was no thought when he was asked, you know, are more people dying from the destruction of food chains, of supply chains for food, for medicine, from deferred medical treatments for cancers, for diabetes, for kidney dialysis, and of starvation around the globe because the supply chains are now shut down, and you know the people in particularly developing countries were starved to death. We put 100 million children around the globe into starvation. And when Tony Fauci was asked about that, does a lockdown going to kill more people than COVID? He said, you know, that's not my area. I'm a public health person. I'm not an economist. So, you know, what he did was a militarized response to COVID. It was clamping down totalitarian controls, clamping down censorship, closing churches, ending jury trials, which he had a direct hand in with the CARES Act, the PREP Act, of giving immunity from liability to all of these companies, of obliterating property rights in this country by closing a million businesses for a year without just compensation or due process. All of our other constitutional rights was a war on the poor. It was a war on our constitutional rights. And it was a war ultimately on democracy. And it was an absolute failure against COVID.
I appreciate the overview. You make the case that Fauci's decades-long career heading the National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Disease is really the story of gross incompetence. His fundamental role should be to effectively respond to public health threats. However, his career's long resume is actually a litany of negligence and failures. The AIDS crisis, anthrax, dengue, Zika virus, the swine flu scares, the epidemic rise in allergic conditions throughout the nation, and now the COVID pandemic. And we only need to look at the health conditions of America's population, especially its children. We're one of the nations in the world, the developed nations, that have the sickest children in the world. We have more arthritis, more obesity, more heart disease, more allergies, and autoimmune conditions in children in any other developed country. And yet no one's paying attention, especially Anthony Fauci. His answer for everything is either a pill or a vaccine. So as a public health official, he's been a dismal failure, in my opinion. Under any normal conditions, an authentic government transparency and oversight of him would have come to the decision that he should not work here. So it begs the question, who are his enablers? He's a bit like Klaus Schwab of the World Economic Forum, another person who personally has not accomplished anything noteworthy during a long career except for hosting large extravaganzas and conferences for the global elite to gather and hatch new ideas and schemes, even though we did not elect them. They were not appointed by us, and yet they have enormous power. 500 of them has more power than 5 million of us, even more. And it just seems like they're just increasing the hegemony over nation states and the global economy. Neither are true visionaries. So if they're just pawns that serve a greater purpose for other non-democratic interest groups, then who are Fauci's enablers? Certainly there are people who protect him in his role with the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease and who are determined to keep him there, because he serves a larger purpose and a mission. And for heaven's sakes, he has managed to head the agency under 7 different presidents. Each incoming administration reviews the successes and failures of prior agency heads, yet Fauci has managed to dodge the cut. That is an unprecedented for any situation for any bureaucrat. So please take your time, much like a classroom on the air, really laid out for this audience. And by the way, you have a worldwide audience that is watching you. We're the number one progressive radio station and program in the world. So a lot of people are going to pay attention to what you're saying and share it with other people. So please continue to unfold your story.
Can you just ask the question? What? I didn't get your question. Are you asking if he's incompetent? I don't think he is. I think incompetence is part of the problem. I think the real problem is that he's been the architect of agency capture within HHS. And agency capture is a phenomenon that happens with every regulatory agency through a number of well-documented forces. Regulatory agencies tend to become gradually over time the sock puppets of the industries that they're supposed to be regulating. And that happens, you know, Gary, with every regulatory agency. I probably brought 500 cases against polluters while I was at Waterkeeper Alliance, but probably 20% of my total cases were against the regulatory agency, were against the EPA and the state regulators, are making deals, sweetheart deals with polluters that are illegal. Because their policies were being dictated by the polluters that they were supposed to regulate. And the same thing has happened at the public health agencies. But in HHS, regulatory capture is on the steroids because of financial entanglements that are unique to public health. For example, FDA gets 50% of its budget, 45% of its budget from pharmaceutical companies. So it's not regulating those companies, it's partners. And it's completely obedient and subservient to those companies. The NIH owns thousands of pharmaceutical patents. NIH has laboratories which help develop these new drugs, and then they patent the drugs. And not only for example, Moderna was developed with $2.5 billion in NIH money that Tony Fauci gave. It also got money from DARPA, from the military. The NIH owns half of that patent. So when that product makes money, the NIH stands to make billions and billions of dollars. Not only that, but under HHS rules, Tony Fauci can designate certain of his underlings to also have margin rights on those patents. So he has designated at least four people of his loyal, deputies at NIAID. That will make now $150,000 a year for life from those patents. Oh, and then CDC has 57 patents, vaccine patents. It's supposed to regulate the industry, but it's making money from it. And if you look at what happens to people who are the directors of CDC, the administrators, one at a time, they go to work for the vaccine companies when they leave. So Julie Gerberding, who ran the agency from 2002 to 2009 and approved all these new Merck vaccines, including the Gardasil vaccine, which is their biggest seller, the MMR vaccine, the chickenpox vaccine, when she left in 2009, and by 2010, she was the vice president of Merck's vaccine division. Merck gave her a $2.9 million salary and $38 million in stock options. So these administrators from CDC know that when they leave, they're going to go to work for the companies they've been regulating, and they need to do them a lot of favors right now in order to cash in, at the end of their careers. So the mercantile aspect, and CDC, by the way, spends $4.9 billion a year buying vaccines from these four companies, from Sanofi, Merck, Glaxo, and Pfizer, and then redistributing, reselling those vaccines to children's programs. Oh, CDC is the biggest vaccine company in this country. And if you work at CDC, you do not make money, you do not get promotions, you do not get salary increases by finding problems with vaccines. The metrics for advancement at CDC require you to actively increase vaccine uptake. And so those mercantile and commercial impulses and incentives have completely obliterated the regulatory function of that agency. It is not doing regulation, it is doing vaccine promotion and medicine promotion. Now, Tony Fauci has been particularly adept at turning his agency into a subsidiary for Big Pharma. Tony Fauci does not do public health. He does pharmaceutical development. Between 2009 and 2016, there were about 240 new drugs approved by FDA, all of which came out of Tony Fauci's shop. Okay, Eric, here's what he does. He, at NIAID, the function of NIAID was to try to figure out where the sources of infectious diseases were coming from and what the cures were and what the sources of chronic disease are, particularly allergic disease and autoimmune disease, which it's in charge of. Oh, since Tony Fauci came in 1968, chronic disease at that time was around 6% in our children, in Americans across the board. Today, it's 54% as of 2006. That's Tony Fauci's legacy. We've gone from the healthiest population in the world with one of the lowest, infant mortality rates, one of the highest longevities, to the sickest country in the top 79 countries on Earth. This generation of American children is the sickest group of children in our country in history. And that's Tony Fauci's legacy. We do spend more on healthcare than any other country in the world with the worst results. We devour and consume more pharmaceutical products about three times what the average Western nation consumes. We pay the highest prices for pharmaceutical products, and we have the worst health outcomes. Those are Tony Fauci's legacy. Listen, in my generation, I'm 67 years old. The autism rate today in 67-year-old men is about between 1 in every 2,500 to 1 in 10,000. We don't know the exact number because CDC won't study it, but we have the old studies that's what they show. And it hasn't changed. But in my kids' generation, the autism rate is 1 in every 34 children, according to HHS. So, and Congress said to EPA, tell us what year the autism epidemic began. And EPA scientists came back and said, there's a straight line, 1989. And by the way, that's not the only chronic disease that exploded, that became pandemic in 1989. We also have food allergies. We have all these other allergies, eczema, wheat allergies, dairy, asthma, and anaphylaxis. We have autoimmune diseases like rheumatoid arthritis, juvenile diabetes, lupus, Graves' disease, Crohn's disease, Guillain-Barré. All of these took off in 1989, and of course, all the neurodevelopmental disorders, ADD, ADHD, speech delay, sleep disorders, tics, Tourette syndrome, stuff I never heard of as a kid. Suddenly, it's all over the place. Narcolepsy. Tony Fauci's job is to ask the question, what happened in 1989 that changed American health so dramatically? We know it has to be an environmental toxin because genes do not cause epidemics. So you have to say, what is an environmental toxin that became ubiquitous somewhere in the early 1990s, affected every demographic from Cubans in Key Biscayne, Miami, to Inuit in Alaska, and is continuing to erode public health today with all of these autoimmune and neurological and allergic disorders. Well, there is a very famous scientist called Phil Langevin who took a look at that question, and he said, there are 11 exposures that are potential culprits. And among those was a glyphosate, the herbicide in Roundup, neonicotinoid pesticides, PFOAs, which is a flame retardant, which they started putting in all the furniture and pajamas that year, around that time, ultrasound, which became ubiquitous on that timeline, and vaccines, which went, you know, we went from 3 vaccines in my generation over the 1990s to the 72 doses of 16 vaccines that are required for this generation. And there's a few other exposures. And so it's a limited, finite group of potential culprits. It's very easy to do the science with existing retrospective data to figure out exactly which one of these, or, you know, which group of them is most responsible for this pandemic of all these diseases. And it could be all of them, or it could be one or more. But it's easy to find out, and that's precisely Tony Fauci's job, to use his budget to answer that question. He doesn't do that. What he does, he has $7.7 billion budget. He gives away twice what Bill Gates gives away every year. And he gives that, he's supposed to be doing these kind of studies, and doing studies like, does vitamin D effective, and is hydroxychloroquine effective, and, you know, is ivermectin and all these other. Are they effective? He doesn't do those. Is masking effective? Those are the kind of things that he needs to answer, but he doesn't. Between him and Gates and Jeremy Farrar, which is the British version of a hybrid, you know, between Gates and Fauci, he's the head of the Wellcome Trust, which was helping with all the gain of function stuff and which helped orchestrate the cover-up. Between the three of them, they control 61% of the biomedical research that's done in the world. So, but not only do they control the kind of science that gets funded, they also control what science doesn't get funded. So listen, what would happen if there was a scientist, a young associate professor at UCLA, who looks around in the literature and he says, you know what, nobody's ever studied the links between autism and the hepatitis B vaccine. It's never been studied. And in fact, the National Academy of Sciences told HHS, you got to study this. It's never been studied. And no study like that has been done of the DTP vaccine or of any of the vaccines that are given during the first 5 months of life. And what if this guy said, you know, that's an easy study to do because we have all the data from Kaiser Permanente, from the big HMO. They have everybody's vaccine records down to batch, the date they got the vaccine, and they have all the medical claims thereafter. So it's easy to do a cluster analysis, machine counting, AI, where you look for correlations between certain vaccines given at certain dates and medical claims for diabetes, arthritis, autism, ADD, ADHD, Adderall, whatever. You can easily figure it out. And if there was a young scientist who proposed to do that study, which absolutely needs to be done, as soon as he proposed that study, Tony Fauci's agency would learn about it. And somebody from Fauci's agency, Cliff Lane or Hugh Auchincloss or one of his hitmen, would call the dean of that medical school at UCLA and say, if you let this joker do this study, we are going to bankrupt you. And they can bankrupt virtually every medical school in this country because they give them hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars a year. That's how he controls the content, the intellectual content of what we understand about science. And so here's what he does. Instead of doing that kind of research, which he ought to be doing, here's what he does. He develops drugs in NIAID's labs. He has, in those labs, they have thousands of petri dishes containing cultures of viruses, of dengue virus, Ebola virus, coronavirus, influenza virus, and other infectious diseases. And he will have his scientists dropping molecules of different kinds of poisons onto those viral cultures to see what kills them. And when they find a combination of molecules that will kill all of the viruses in that culture, they say, this is a potential antiviral drug. And they give it to rats. And if it doesn't kill the rats, but it does kill the virus, they say, now we have something that's a medicine. Then he farms it out to the university for phase one studies, and it will go to what they call a PI. This is important for people to understand. A PI is a principal investigator. They're usually a high-level powerhouse at that university. It's the dean of the department or the chair. And they're the ones that get the money for the clinical trials that bring so much money into that university. And if you want to know what a PI looks like, turn on CNN. And whenever you see somebody who says, I'm a medical expert, virtually all those medical experts, Art Clack Kaplan, Peter Hotez, Paul Offit, and on and on, people that they put on night after night after night, who claim to be independent, those are PIs, and almost all of them are Tony Fauci's PIs. So they're on Tony Fauci's payroll. Their livelihoods depend on his good humor towards them. That's never identified on CNN. But those are the PIs. They control the messaging. They're also called KNIs, which means knowledge and information experts. And what happens is, so that person, a PI, the Peter Hotez of the office, will recruit 100 people for a phase one study. And Tony Fauci, and this is typical, so I'm not telling you, I'm telling you kind of a schematic of how it works rather than a particular instance or accurate numbers, but they're sort of close enough. Tony Fauci's agency will give that PI $15,000 for every one of those 100 people that he recruits to this study. He's a doctor, so he's recruiting patients to participate in the clinical trial. And the university will skim off between 50 and 75% of that money and keep it. So now the university is hooked in. They now are reliant on these clinical trials happening year after year because so much of their revenue is coming from them. And then if it passes the clinical trial, they go to phase two, and they have to start giving them to much larger groups of people. And the money gets really huge, really fast. They're going to spend, you know, $250 billion on this thing, on developing this drug. I mean, $250 billion, $250 million they could spend on it. And a lot of that is going to go through the university. So now they have to recruit a pharmaceutical company who comes in. Fauci will hold on typically to part of the patent for his agency and gives the rest to the pharmaceutical company. The pharmaceutical company shares the patent with the university and with the PI. So now all of them are plugged into this revenue stream. And then they work this through the process, and then they have to take it to FDA to get approved by an independent committee that is called VRBPAC or one of the other committees. Who is sitting on that committee? It's not people who work for FDA. They are outside experts. And you hear Fauci all the time talking about well, this drug is good because it was approved by outside experts, you know, the experts in the field. Who are they? Virtually all of them are Tony Fauci's PIs from other universities. Oh, he has the whole system wired. His guys are sitting at every level making the decisions, and they know that their revenues are going to be cut off if they don't approve this drug. So the drugs, no matter how dangerous they are, no matter how ineffective, are on the track to get approved. And then at the end of the process, they have to publish the clinical trial results. Where they publish them in JAMA, New England Journal of Medicine, or one of the other journals, and those are totally controlled by the pharmaceutical companies. So even Richard Horton, who's the head of the Lancet, you know, for iconic editor of the Lancet for a generation, he says you can't believe anything in the Lancet anymore. It's all, they have become propaganda and marketing vessels for the vaccine, for the pharmaceutical companies, because 80 or 95% of their revenues comes from pharma. They're very profitable, those journals. Their revenues come from big pharma. And then when they publish, the big revenues come from reprints. What is a reprint? When they publish a study that says Vioxx really works and it doesn't kill people, okay, two things that are completely lies, and they know are lies. The Lancet will publish that study. Merck will come and say, we want 1 million reprints of that study. And Lancet will run off those reprints with its masthead on top. Merck distributes those to its pharmaceutical reps, who bring a copy of that Lancet reprint to every doctor in America and say, you should be pushing Vioxx, because here the Lancet says it's great. The whole system is fixed and everybody's making money, and the public is getting less and less healthy. And nobody is concerned about public health because the whole system is about selling pharmaceutical drugs and not taking care of public health. And that's what Tony Fauci does. And he has orchestrated the creation of that system. So now his agency is the single biggest incubator for new pharmaceutical products. And everybody's making money on it, and everybody's losing their health. And that's what he does. And that's why he had to kill all of these repurposed medications like hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin, the stuff that we know would have wiped out, would have obliterated COVID. We would not have had a pandemic. He had to kill them because he had a $93 billion payday. As long as they can force people to take the vaccines and paint the vaccines as the only public health option. And that's what he was up to. And there's one other thing that people should know. Under federal law, you cannot get a product like one of these vaccines, cannot get emergency use authorization if there is a previously approved product, and it could be approved for any use, that is found effective to treat the target disease. Oh, if anybody could make the point that hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin were indeed effective against COVID, it would be illegal for all of those vaccine companies to get an emergency use authorization, and the entire project would have collapsed. And that's why you saw this targeted propaganda campaign crusade to destroy ivermectin as a D-word. It's a horse dewormer. It's not for him. Of course, it's for human beings. That's like saying, you know, that antibiotics are used for veterinary purposes, not for humans. It's the same antibiotic, and it's a molecule, and it works on all mammals, and it's going to work in humans and horses. Just because it works in humans and horses does not make it a veterinary medicine. It won the Nobel Prize for what it does in human beings. the only drug ever to win the Nobel Prize. And it won it because it's so effective against parasites, and it turns out it's equally effective against viruses.
You couldn't get any more of an answer into that if you used a shoehorn. That was very definitive. If you're just watching us, we're 45 minutes into our program. We only have 10 minutes to go. Robert Kennedy Jr. is here. Robert, there was one revelation that really shocked me. I'm familiar with the earlier gain-of-function research and the coronavirus pandemic simulations conducted in October 1919 by Bill Gates, the World Economic Forum, Johns Hopkins University. Before the Wuhan outbreak was announced, and that's the key. It's as if everything they simulated came true. Might be a coincidence, might not. There were other very shady characters at that gathering, as well as who you might want to mention. Events 201's precursor might be seen as the dark winter simulations about an anthrax outbreak that were conducted of just a few months before 9/11. However, I was unaware that the October event 201 was only one of many events that were taking place around the world for years. They were all in preparation for a forthcoming declaration of a global pandemic. To name just a few for the listeners, there were years of top-off exercises that were designed to deal with this. Can you go through this in more detail and tell us about what was going on, who was a part of it, and why this wasn't necessarily just a guesswork, a coincidence, that they would have all these meetings, plan all this, and then suddenly something would happen? I don't believe that they're that clairvoyant.
You're talking about Event 201. Event 201 was a pandemic simulation that was hosted, that is on the internet. People can go and look at it. And it was hosted by, it was a pandemic simulation that was hosted in at the Pierre Hotel in New York City in October of 2019. The significance of the date is this, that the best estimate for when COVID-19 began circulating is September 12, 2019. We know that because the national security agencies have determined that that's when it escaped. That's when the Chinese government found out about it, because the hospital parking lots began filling up. The Chinese government went into the Wuhan lab, replaced the director with a military director, and got rid of all the gain of function, the public facing sites for the gain of function, and purged a lot of the really incriminating ones from the internet, and then removed 22,000 coronavirus samples from the Wuhan lab. So a month later, there's a coronavirus simulation in New York City, and they're simulating a global coronavirus pandemic. The hosts of it are Bill Gates and Avril Haines, who is the deputy director, former deputy director of the CIA. She is now the chief top spy in America. She is the director of the National Security Agency in charge of the coronavirus response. Why was the CIA there? The CIA is not a health agency. The CIA does not do public health. The CIA does coup d'etats, mostly, as it turns out, against democracies. The CIA has been involved in at least 73 coup d'etats that we know of between 1948 and the year 2000. So why were they at a pandemic response simulation? The other odd person there is George Gao, the head of the Chinese CDC, who must have known, since the Chinese government knew, that coronavirus was already circulating. And they spend a whole day talking about coronavirus, about how to handle a coronavirus pandemic and how to respond, but there's never any talk of a medical response. They're not talking about repurposed medications or connecting all of the doctors, the 11 million doctors in the world on a grid to communicate with each other and figure out the most successful protocols or repurpose medications. There's no talk about stockpiling vitamin D and zinc and distributing it to people and getting people to strengthen their immune systems and all this. There's nothing like that. And quarantining the sick, nothing. It's all about how do you use a pandemic to clamp down totalitarian controls and execute the controlled demolition of democracy globally. That's what they're talking about. The last seminar of that day is a seminar on censorship. How do you get the social media companies, the mainstream media companies, to impose censorship on talk that that challenges official orthodoxy? And by the way, at this simulation, in addition to the characters that I just mentioned, is high-level officials from the pharmaceutical industry, including Johnson & Johnson, the world's biggest pharmaceutical company, social media companies, mainstream media companies like Bloomberg and Washington Post, etc. And they're all talking and endorsing censorship. And the key item that they are obsessed about censoring, and George Gale brings this up, the Chinese CDC director, is how do we censor it when people start saying this is a lab-generated virus? So, and anybody can go and look this up. And what is, Gary, as you point out, during the, you know, when I was researching my book, I discovered that this was not a one-off event, but I was able to document at least a dozen other events that they were doing virtually every year for the past 20 years. They were doing these kind of simulations, and each one of them, there was a heavy, heavy presence by the CIA. And in each one, there were CIA officers, high level, sometimes four or five of them present. And most of them would have a high level recognized official like Bill Gates or Sam Nunn, the senator on the Defense Committee, Senator Gary Hart, Madeleine Albright, congressman, et cetera, to give it kind of an imprimatur of legitimacy. But they involved, many of them were classified, and they involved hundreds of thousands of people. They were drilling not just high-level officials and health officials, but also local cops, firefighters, frontline people, hospital systems, public utilities. The FBI and the CIA were at them, and they were drilling them not just in our country, but simultaneously in Canada, Europe, Australia, etc. So it was, and they were, you know, the series was called Operation Lockstep. And as it turns out, it was what they were drilling is the lockstep pivot of virtually all of the liberal constitutional democracies in the world away from constitutional rights and civil governance and democratic governance towards totalitarian systems. And it is really, it's illuminating. I urge people, if you're gonna get the book, you know, if you're hesitant about reading the whole book, and it's a long book, go to the Germ Games chapter, and you will see something really frightening, which is that it appears that this whole response, you know, that has been so bewildering to all of us, that it was carefully drilled and carefully planned over many, many years, and that its outcome is totalitarian governance. Oh, Gary, thank you so much for having me. As you know, I'm a long, long time collaborator and admirer of yours. I would urge people, you know, my book is the most censored book in the world right now. Not a single news organization has printed a review of it. It is banned from discussion on YouTube and Facebook. And I've only been able to go on two programs, television programs, one Sports Circus, where I had a great time, and the other on Tucker Carlson. So, but nevertheless, it's been the top seller in the world all week. This is the first week. We've sold over 120,000 copies. The top book last week was Will Smith's book, number one on the New York Times list, and it only sold 85,000 copies. And so, you know, we don't know if the New York Times is going to put us on the top of its list. We know they're going to do everything they can to avoid it. But the one act of civil disobedience that everybody who's watching this show can do, you know, if you want to know what you can do, go out and buy a copy of the book. Hopefully you'll buy it not from Jeff Bezos, but if you have to buy it from Amazon, do. But it's preferable to buy it from Barnes & Noble or to buy it from your local bookstore. That's the best. To go into an independent, walk in and get it, and get a couple of copies. Give them to your relatives who think you're crazy about your views on these vaccines. Give them to your friends for Christmas. Every one of them is an act of defiance against the establishment. Every time you buy one of these, it's your act of defiance. So I don't get any money from the book, by the way. 100% of the profits go to Children's Health Defense to fund our litigation, to fund our communication. Please join Children's Health Defense. Follow us on The Defender. That's the way you can stay informed. We have the biggest fact-checking and most rigorous fact-checking organization of any publication now that I know of on the planet. And when you come on our site, we want you to come to a place where you can rely on the science. So join Children's Health Defense, join the resistance, and do your little, each one of us. We're going to win this one person at a time. And everyone has an obligation to do a civil disobedience every day. And that could just be walking up to another person, a mother who's carrying a baby like I did this morning, and saying, before you vaccinate that baby, do your independent research. That could be your act of civil disobedience for the day. It could be going to a store where they have a, you know, mask mandatory sign on it and saying to the owner, I respect you, but I'm never going to shop in here again, and I'm going to tell my friends don't until you stop discriminating, or no, or vax, or whatever. It could be handing a card. If we have cards, or putting up stickers, which inform people about what's really happening. You need to do two or three civil disobediences every day, because we need to start, you know, the way that propaganda works, Gary, you know this, is that if people hear a message once, they'll dismiss it. But if they hear it four or five times, they think it's true. And so you have the mainstream media, that's CNN, constantly telling people, be scared. The only solution is vaccine. Stay locked in your home. And what we need, the way to counter that, is we need people to hear the message four or five times. And it's much more effective if it comes from a human being than from the TV. We can convert these people. All the conversions go from our side to theirs, and nobody, when they're awake, goes back to the matrix. So now do your part. Buy the book, support Children's Health Defense, support the resistance, and watch Gary, because he is the voice of the resistance and has been for many, many years. So thank you, Gary, for having me.
Thank you, Robert. I look forward to our next interview. The book is The Real Anthony Fauci, Bill Gates, Big Pharma, and the Global War on Democracy and Public Health. The websites, childrenshealthdefense.org and robertfkennedyjr.com. Let us work together, and especially the classic and historical liberal community. What happened? How did all of the liberal organizations suddenly abandon the truth and become biased? Insist that Robert have a chance to come on and debate whoever they believe is against him and is the best voice. He's not allowed to debate. If he did, this information he shared today would come in every house in America. They're keeping that, and it was all planned. Robert Kennedy, we need 1,000 of you writing books and speaking. Thank you very much for being with us today. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening and watching, and have a nice day.